gonna raise a holler.
Okay, so I am here with two men in one. I'm here with John Banville, who is most recently the author of The Infinities, and I'm here with Benjamin Black, who is most recently the author of A Death in Summer. John, Benjamin, nice to meet you.
Yes, we're both very glad to be here. We speak with one voice.
You do, okay. You contain multitudes.
Ah, yes, I contain multitudes.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something that has interested me. You have said that you hate all the John Banville books, but the Benjamin Black books, I gather, both from reading them and from other interviews you've done, are really a load of fun. I'm curious why writing for you has to be this act of hate or torture or intensity. I mean, have there been any moments as John Banville where you've greatly enjoyed yourself, almost on the level of Benjamin Black?
I've been very intemperate in talking about Banville's books.
Yeah.
I have to make it clear. They're better than everybody else's. They're just not good enough for me.
Yeah.
It's a quest for perfection. It's an obsession, which I know is, you know, slight edge of sickness to it, but that's what I do. That's how I work. My effort is to get closer and closer and closer to the perfect sentence. I work in sentences. That's my unit. Poets work in lines. I work in sentences. And I have to keep working at sentences until they, as I say, until they're as near to being right as I can get them. But we can't do that. I mean, as Beckett says, all we can do is fail again, fail better.
Yeah.
So I try to fail a little better every time. It's like the infinitesimal calculus. I'm getting a little closer to it every time, but I never will actually reach it. The Black books are, I hope, well-crafted. And they're not obsessive in that way. They're written swiftly. They're written fluently. They are meant to be the product of spontaneity, whereas Banville's work is the product of concentration. So two entirely different ways of working. And it's easier to like the Black books because I have more fun writing them.
Yeah.
But of course, when I'm doing a Banville book, every once in a while I hear that chime, like when you hit the edge of a wine glass with your fingernail, ding.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that I've got, you know, this is a well-wrought sentence.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, being a novelist, I make, you know, sentences and I add sentence to sentence. And eventually I have a paragraph and then I have a chapter and then one day I have a book.
Why can't the quest for perfection be an act of fun?
Because it's doomed to failure.
Yeah. Because you get involved with ego?
Every novelist will tell you this, I think, that when you start out a book, you're absolutely buoyant. You think, this is going to be the greatest novel that's ever been published. This is going to knock the world back on its heels. You know, I'll get two Nobel Prizes. They'll give me the Nobel Peace Prize as well, just for good measure. You know rationally that it's going to be another botched attempt at perfection.
Mm-hmm.
But you keep these two sides going, and then somewhere in the middle of the book, the two sort of coalesce. That's the grimiest and grimmest stage of writing a novel. I don't have that with Black, because Black moves so swiftly.
Yeah.
The thing is done, practically, before I know that I'm doing it.
On the other hand, I did note the phrase lowering turrets that was in the Benjamin Black book, which could easily have also been in a John Banville book. I'm wondering if there is any possible quest for perfection in spurts with a Benjamin Black book.
No, I can't afford that. Sometimes, you know, in the middle of the afternoon when my eyelids are getting heavy, a Black may lean over Banville's shoulder and try to write a sentence, or Banville may lean over Black's shoulder and try to write a sentence. But when I'm revising the books and I find these passages or these sentences, they have to be taken out.
Huh.
Not that they're bad, but they're wrong. They're in the wrong place. They're like weeds. You know, a weed is a herb that's out of place.
Yeah.
So the Banville has to be weeded out of the Black, or the Black has to be weeded out of the Banville. As I say, totally separate ways of working.
Yeah. So you've probably written some beautiful Banville-ish passages in the Benjamin Black books that you've had to basically extirpate.
Very swiftly.
Yeah.
No, I'm not against beauty. I mean, a well-crafted sentence is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
I suppose the distinction is that, and to be, you know, to simplify it, the distinction is that Black is a craftsman and Banville is an artist.
Yeah.
I value both of them equally. In fact, I think we could do with far more craftsmen, or I suppose nowadays I have to say craftspeople in the world, than we have need for artists. You know, fewer artists, more craftsmen, I think, would be a good thing for the world.
But you're now facing a dilemma where the Benjamin Black complete works may very well outshadow the John Banville.
Oh yes, account. I have a fantasy that biographical dictionary of writers 2050 will be, you know, Banville John, C. Black Benjamin, you know. and under Banville there'll be, you know, author of many novels, all out of print now, but Black having won the Nobel Prize, Banville changed his name to Black permanently. Or, some, you know, or there is some suspicion that, in fact, Banville was an invention of Benjamin Black.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to actually ask about something. In a Paris Review interview, you mentioned that as a teenager, you typed out terrible pastiches of Joyce on a Remington. When was the last time in the career of either Black or Banville that you have relied in any sense on pastiches or parodies or trying to mimic pre-existing text? Did you have to do that for that fateful morning where you sat down and first wrote 1,500 words as Benjamin Black? Or?
No. He was an original.
Yeah.
You couldn't make books out of imitations of others. I mean, that would be death.
Yeah.
Everything has to be as near to original as it possibly can. Of course, because we the generation guided us before we came out of our mother's womb, to quote what's his name again. Of course, the people who came before me bear a great weight upon my work, upon my style, upon my ideas, upon everything. Mm-hmm. We are not born fully armed from our own heads. You know, we come from a tradition.
What was the point where you really realized, I have to shake off the influence of all of the people who came before me, all of the writers and the artists and the craftsmen? I mean, that quest for the original seems to have been planted in there early on. But on the other hand, I also see a kind of a flirtation with commercial fiction. I know that you wrote early pieces for Argosy, which you have not allowed to be recollected in any previous...
God, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. I know also that The Untouchable almost might be kind of some compromise. It could be argued.
The Untouchable, I think, is the first manifestation of Black. Yes, yeah. The Untouchable is definitely... could have been written by Black, I think. But yes, you know, I don't like the separation of... I don't like these ghettos that fiction is now being put into. When I started publishing, there was fiction.
Yeah.
It was good or it wasn't good. And of course, there were crime novels and detective novels and so on. But now there's something called literary fiction, which is a corner of the shop that nobody's going to visit, you know?
Yeah.
This is where the marble effigies are kept. Don't come near here. This is terrible. I would like to see a bookshop that all its books are simply in alphabetical order.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no, you know, crime or biography or history or fiction. There's just books. Because good writing, transcendentally good writing, can happen in any of these so-called genres. It can happen in crime fiction, it can happen in history, in biography, in letters, in what have you. So, you know, this compartmentalizing of literature is a bad thing.
So you're making the case that essentially literary fiction could also be its own ghettoized genre.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it is. That's what it's become. I was looking in quite a good kiosk in Boston in the train station there today. It's a really nice little bookshop. But it has, you know, fiction, current fiction, and then it has literature.
Yeah.
And literature is, you know, that's the one that everybody's going to avoid.
Yeah.
Who wants to be reading literature? Something only becomes literature by force of time. Things that were literature 100 years ago are forgotten now.
Yeah.
Things that are remembered now will be forgotten in 100 years' time. Things come and go. Reputations lapse. And, I mean, Henry James was practically forgotten for 40 years after his death.
Yeah.
Beckett's fiction now, Beckett's prose works are now going into the same kind of decline, I think. He's being regarded and remembered almost solely as a dramatist, whereas he said himself that the plays were only footnotes to the novels.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things come and go, and it would be better, as I say, not to have this separation of species.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, because I read it and I said to myself, wow, if Donald Westlake, he wrote Memory, and that was recently put out by Hard Case Crime. And when I read it, I said to myself, oh my God, if Westlake had continued along these lines, he might very well have written very similarly to what you have done as John Banville. I'm curious if you've read Memory or if...
I haven't read Memory, but I knew... it was very sad. He and I became friends, and then he upped and died. I think it must be the curse of Banville. You know? Yeah, I think he's a wonderful writer. I think those Parker books are some of the best writing of the 20th century.
Yeah.
Half a dozen of them are masterpieces.
Yeah.
Same is true of Georges Simenon. Same is true of James M. Cain. There are people writing nowadays, Michael Connelly, the Irish guy, Dennis Lehane, and so on. They're probably doing stuff that's going to live as well.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean, lots of... It may well be that lots of so-called literary fiction that's being produced now will wither and fade away.
Yeah.
And what's being looked down on now is crime fiction. May well live. In the way that Chandler lived when so many of his contemporaries who were lionized at the time are entirely forgotten.
So you're saying that Richard Stark, Simenon, all of these people are just as worthy of the same accolades as, say, Joyce or Beckett or
Kafka. If they write well, yes.
Yeah. So I really the see. Only...
It's a, again, it's a different kind of... I have to be careful here. I would make a distinction. Of course... The Boatsman Always Rings Twice by James M. Cain is a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece in its own way. He wrote it in a long weekend.
Yeah.
Joyce spent 10 years carving out Ulysses. You cannot compare them.
Yeah.
And I'm not comparing them. I'm simply saying that in its way, The Boatsman Always Rings Twice is a masterpiece in the same way that Ulysses, in its way, is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes.
I would agree with you.
Yeah. And in fact, the Modern Library would agree with you as well.
Yeah, it's talking about... apples and pears. You can't compare them.
There was an interesting article recently in The New Yorker, The Last New Yorker, by Joanna Covina, which I'm sure you've seen. It pointed out that neither Banville nor Black can escape this sense of perplexity about how we change as we move through time, and how, as Banville writes, pieces of lost time surface suddenly in the murky sea of memory, bright and clear and fantastically detailed, complete little islands where it seems it might be possible to live, even if only for a moment. Is it possible for you to shake off entirely the thematic commitment, for example, when you're working on a Benjamin Black situation? We were talking earlier about how language seems to riff in each Benjamin Black and also John Banville. But I'm wondering if there is, in fact, some thematic commitment as Benjamin Black. I bring this up specifically because I observe this interesting element of Jewish identity in A Death in Summer. And so I'm wondering, do you have any sort of almost George Pelicanos, David Simon sociological ambitions? What of the question that...
I have no sociological ambitions whatsoever. Yeah. These are works of fiction.
Yeah.
Their relation to the world is contingent. A novel looks like and feels like, sometimes tastes like, smells like life, but it's nothing like life.
Yeah.
Life is a big incoherent mess. We don't remember our birth, we won't experience our death. All we have is this big mess in the middle. A work of art, even if it's a work of crime fiction, a crafted work of crime fiction, it's rounded, it's polished, it's burnished, it's complete in itself. That's the great attraction of art for us, that we have what the great critic Frank Kermode called the sense of an ending. Because we never get that in life. Nothing ends in life except, of course, the inevitable end. Nothing is ever completed in life, but works of fiction are.
Yeah.
And that's the great attraction. That longing we have for completion, for an ending, a neat ending, to live in a circle. I mean, we live in a straight line, but we'd love to live in a sphere.
I wanted to also bring up the ending of this Covina article. She writes, "Why did Banville bifurcate? Perhaps for money, a good enough reason for anything, perhaps for fun, perhaps as a nod to the world of other people, even as he conserves himself to be an outsider, perhaps because he is no literary snob and knows that any genre can produce its classics, perhaps because he knows that literary genres, publishing games, and authorial identities are only half the story, and that beneath them somewhere lies the real interest, life itself, the strangest case of all." I think
it's a nice piece of writing.
Yes. Well,
And I would agree with him.
Yeah. You would agree with all of that, just to sort of cut through her rhetoric that you bifurcated for all those reasons?
Yes, of course. I wanted to make money. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to experiment. Looking back now, I can see that Vanville was somewhat in a rut and needed a kick, needed a jolt.
Yeah.
And inventing another character to vie with him, another novelist to vie with him, was as good a way of giving him a jolt as anything else.
Yeah.
So all those reasons, of course.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I don't know. We imagine that we go through life making decisions and that we're rational creatures. We're not. We drift. We drift. We drift. It's only in hindsight that we put a shape on things.
Do you think that Banville was always leading up to Benjamin Black in hindsight? Or
no.
No?
No, I think Black was a sudden wild frolic that Banville took. It started, I had a television script that wasn't going to be made into a, wasn't going to get to the screen, and I hate to waste anything. So I turned that into Christine Falls.
Yeah.
And now, ironically, the Black books are going to be turned into television by the BBC.
I did see that, yeah.
So it comes full circle. But no, I don't think. I was as surprised as everybody else by the emergence of Black.
But reaching a mass audience, how long has that been a concern of yours? From the very beginning? Or?
Oh, I would like to reach a mass audience, but I know that's not possible for Banville.
Yeah.
I mean, it is possible. When I won the Man Booker Prize,
yeah,
the sales of that book were about 10 times what it would normally be. Yeah. So people at least bought it, whether they read it or not. But I think they did, because people, you know, it was a wonderful thing that happened after the sea won that prize. My wife was in a department store, Marks and Spencer's, you know, in Dublin. And she gave in her credit card, and the woman said, "Oh, you related to John Banville." And she said, "Tell him that the sea is the most beautiful thing I've ever read."
Yeah.
I said, "Tell him that comes from a checkout lady in Marks and Spencer's." That's, to me, worth a sheaf of glowing reviews.
Yeah.
And the other great, I mean, the best review I've ever had, I've told this story many times, so you may have come across it. Well, in a previous book of mine, The Book of Evidence, was shortlisted for the Booker Prize in 1989. I was running for the train one morning, and there's a workman on a bicycle going past. Because I'd been shortlisted, my picture had been in the papers and so on, so he obviously recognized me, came towards me at high speed. I thought I was going to be attacked. Just before he was about to hit me, veered away and said, "Great fucking book."
Yeah.
And I thought, I will never, ever get a review that good again.
Yeah.
So I don't write for, even Banville, you know, he doesn't write for book reviewers or academics or posterity. Banville writes, first of all, for himself and then for readers.
Yeah.
And readers occur at all levels. You know, I mean, you know, you don't have to be an intellectual to read Banville. Unfortunately, poor old Banville has got the reputation of being a writer's writer, which is disastrous for any writer.
Yeah.
Because then it's like, you know, being put in the literary fiction ghetto in the corner of the shop. People say, "Oh, I wouldn't read him."
Yeah.
And I frequently meet people who say, "I read that book of yours. I really enjoyed it." In a tone of absolute amazement, you know.
Because they actually made it their way to the end? Because I often
no,
hear
no,
this.
No, no, because they're saying, I didn't expect. I expected to be intimidated by it. I expected it to be full of high-flown things. I didn't expect it to be funny, for instance. You know, people's expectations. In this day and age, I mean, look, you go into a bookshop nowadays, there are so many books, my God. And new books coming out all the time. There's a place in England called Hay on Wye where they have a literary festival. And the town is completely consists of bookshops.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There are no other shops in Hay on Wye except bookshops.
Yeah.
It is I went there once, so I would never go again. It's an absolute nightmare. It is every writer's nightmare. Mm-hmm. You're wandering through a town which is all bookshops, and the streets are filled with writers wandering around. It is the writer's nightmare. Oh, God. There are too many books around. You know, publishers now, they used to apply some discrimination. Now they work on the lottery principle. You know, if you publish a lot of them, one of them will win. And it's so much cheaper now to publish books.
What are your thoughts on the e-book revolution, so to speak?
I have none, because I don't understand it.
You don't understand
it? Somebody tried to get me to do a Kindle, but I couldn't read a Kindle.
you can't do it because you can't read
My mind just won't grasp this. I mean, this is not a book to me, it's a book, which is one of the greatest pieces of technology ever invented by man. There's a wonderful YouTube thing, and if you've seen it, of two monks. Mm-hmm. There's a monk with a book on the table, and he's called in another monk from the technological help department, right?
Yeah.
And he's saying, I can't, what do I do with this? The other monk says, well, you see, you open it like this, and he opens the cover, you know?
Yeah.
I says, oh, just like that, you just open it, yeah, you just open it like that. And what about, on these sheets that you can turn over, is all this information contained. The guy said, wow, this is amazing. And it's very, very funny. And at the end, they come to the end of the book, so it's turned the other way, right?
Yeah.
It's turned on its face. And the tech guy is leaving, and the monk says, hey, wait, I can't open this. The guy says, no, that's the spine.
Yeah.
You have to go turn it over and stuff. And it's a perfect piece of, you know, it's funny, but it also shows just what a technological object the book is.
Yes.
So I can't see it being bettered. Now, of course, if you go on a trip, like me, my suitcases are, you know, they weigh half a ton because they're filled with books. But that's like taking a security blanket for me. I have to have my books. I know that I won't even open most of them, but I have to have them with me.
It may not necessarily be a technology that you understand, and I happen to agree with you. I don't have any Kindles. I don't have a Kobo. I don't have a Sony e-reader. On the other hand, we were talking earlier about audience, and there might very well be a new audience for either Benjamin Black or John Mandeville if you were to open it up
Gates. Sorry, I thought you were asking, did I read them?
I'm perfectly
happy for my books to become e-books and whatever. I mean, as I say, I want my books to be read.
Yeah.
You know,
did you ever make an attempt to use a Kindle, or...?
Well, no, I mean, somebody, you know, said, you know, would you like one? And I said, I tried to read a page or two, and no, couldn't do it.
Okay.
I just didn't feel right with this. The shape wasn't right. The whole process wasn't right.
Yeah. I wanted to go talk about Death in Summer. Quirk has this interesting reputation throughout the books of getting involved with murder suspects and those who are often the murder victim. You know, or those who are close to the murder victim. But in A Death in Summer, there's no real expectation for his unanticipated affair. He just kind of gets involved with Françoise. You do have one line late in the book where you write, he was at an age he suddenly realized when female beauty provoked admiration in him more often than desire. I'm wondering if you plan to explore more of Quirk's emotional connections in these particular fling, or is Black simply a man who only cares about flinging Quirk into a fling, so to speak, much as the way that, you know, Richard Stark kind of throws a woman at Parker.
It's interesting because, you know, when you... This is, I think, the fourth Quirk book now. Well, it's a lot of books.
Yeah.
For, you know, to have one consistent character. I find that I'm becoming really interested in the people around Quirk.
Yeah.
His daughter Phoebe, his assistant Sinclair, Quirk to me is quite enigmatic. I don't really understand him.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's very much there to understand. I think he's something of a hollow man. It came to me recently that perhaps Quirk is down among the dead. You know, maybe he's a kind of Persephone figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm Orpheus, I have to go down and bring him up into the light. He's a pathologist, he works with the dead, he works in a windowless basement. I never intended these things to be in this heavily symbolic way, but it seems to me now that he is a sort of lost soul.
Yeah.
And maybe the end of this series of books, whenever, might be when somehow I save him, bring him up into the light, allow him to live fully. Give him more emotions. I don't know. That's the adventure. That's the wonderful thing about doing a series.
Do you think Banville would give Quirk more...
Well, this is a problem, yes. Yeah. It's a problem that if I get interested in Quirk's existential predicament, I'll have to call in Banville for advice, and Black would not like that.
Yeah. Have you contemplated perhaps writing the Benjamin Black universe from the John Banville perspective and vice versa? Or?
Somebody asked me last night in Boston if I would ever contemplate writing, you know, a collaboration between the two of them.
Yeah.
A Banville-Black book. And it has crossed my mind, but I don't know how I would do it.
Yeah.
I don't think, I mean, in a way I have done it. As you said, The Untouchable is a sort of bound for black book. The Book of Evidence is a bound for black book. So, one of the problems about crime fiction, I find, is that, you know, you can have a novel with a crime in it, but you can't have a crime novel without a crime in it. And the technical challenge in that, writing a crime novel that hasn't actually got a crime, would be. Yeah. That, so Vanville might lend a hand on that one.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, this is a wonderful adventure I've embarked on.
Does the crime often get in the way of exploring the characters or having fun with the characters?
I have no interest in exploring characters.
Yeah.
I present them. I move them in my head, and I present on the page what I see in my head. Their inner lives are a mystery to me, just as the inner lives of the people I meet every day are a mystery to me. You know, we can't know other human beings.
Yeah.
All we can even attempt to know is ourselves, because we're inside ourselves. Yeah. We can't know other people. All we have is surface.
I wanted to actually ask about the chapter with Father Ambrose. You write, he drew on his cigarette as if he were tasting some fabulous and costly vintage. Now, I should point out that if I had read that sentence a year ago when I was quitting smoking successfully, I would have easily gone back onto the cigarettes. But the thing...
I had a nice message from Roddy Doyle last evening saying he'd finished it and how much he admired it, and said, you know, I gave up smoking a long time ago, but this really put me back on them.
I know. I came very close. I actually, I had a craving, thanks to you. But I'm curious about the fact that that there is this great, wonderful emotional intensity when it comes to drinking, when it comes to smoking, and of course, food. Is this some fantasy wish fulfillment on your part of wanting to I suppose?
No, that's how people were in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to remember that Ireland was an incredibly sexually repressed society. Sex was the greatest sin in the eyes of the church.
Yeah.
Sex itself was a sin. You know, they just barely tolerated it between married couples, because otherwise the religion would die out, you know. But it was an incredibly suppressed... I mean, Quirk gets far more sex than anybody really would have got in the 1950s, believe me. Yeah. Because apart from anything else, women were terrified of getting pregnant. Because that was the worst stigma of all. You got pregnant outside marriage in Ireland in the 50s. You were a lost creature. So I'm exaggerating a bit. But yes, everybody smoked, everybody drank to excess. So a friend of mine was telling me recently, she was talking to some friend of hers about Quirk, saying, you know, he must have been a very attractive man. Would have been a very attractive man. And her friend said, yeah, but he would smell, because he drinks so much and he smokes so much. But in those days, everybody drank and smoked.
Yeah.
So everybody smelled. So sort of the smells cancelled each other out. But yes, I mean, because he is so emotionally suspended, of course he seeks gratification through the senses, through smoking, through drinking, through eating, and the occasional girl that he managed to get his hands on.
In a dual interview that you did with Donald Westlake, who we mentioned earlier, which appeared in Newsweek a few years ago, you remarked about the way readers want the priest in you. Readers think that you know more than you do. How much does a novelist need to know of reality in order to create a persuasive simulacrum?
Almost nothing.
Yeah.
The imagination operates almost independently of one's knowledge of the world. I can write about things that in my daily life I know nothing about.
Yeah.
You know, people say to me, I remember a woman coming to me when the Book of Evidence was published, she said, you know, I work in prisons. You must have been in prison at some stage. And I said, no, and I've never killed anybody, and I've never been a woman, and I've never been a dog. I write about all these things.
Yeah.
People only notice the thing that they... But, you know, the imagination makes a world. And we all know this. Every night when we go to sleep, our imaginations make these extraordinary extravaganzas, fictionalized versions of our lives.
Yeah.
Which, if we could control them, the world would be flooded with novels. Everybody would get up every morning and produce a novel.
Yeah. I'm curious. It seems to me, then, that your imagination is very much about looking at about 60 different angles of a situation, or in this concentration period, I'm guessing, and maybe you could elaborate upon this, that you're trying to, what is this process in terms of looking at a situation, looking at that, okay, I'm at this particular point in the text. How many hours do you have to spend to slide the book forward, so to speak?
That can take a morning to write a sentence.
Yeah.
Then in the afternoon, I might write a couple of paragraphs. I mean, it depends. It depends how difficult the concept is, how intangible. How much labor I have to expend on bringing it into reality, bringing it into existence. You know, the wisp of a notion, the wisp of a nuance of an idea has to be put into words.
Yeah.
That's what I spend my day doing. Concentration is the answer. Somebody once asked Isaac Newton, how on earth did he formulate this vast system for the cosmos? And he said, by thinking upon it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an absolute belief that if one is lucky enough to be given the power of concentration, that one could do anything.
Yeah.
One can produce anything. And, you know, then there's one of my mottos comes from, Cato the Censor. It says, rem tene verbum sequentur. Grasp the object, the words will follow.
Yes.
And I think that this is the best advice that a writer could have, four words. Best, because to concentrate on the object itself. Forget about your own feelings about it or your own notion of it. Whenever writers ask me, young writers ask me for advice, I say, just work. Look at the world. Stop thinking about yourself or your opinions. Writing is not about expressing yourself.
Yeah.
Writing is not a matter of expressing yourself. You will express yourself by a roundabout fashion.
Looking at the world versus using your imagination to conjure up.
No, the imagination makes the world.
Yeah.
Imagination conjures the world into existence. When Rilke went to work with Rodin in Paris, Rilke was very much a kinesthete and one of those precious poets in the 1890s, really. And Rodin said to him, il faut travailler, il faut toujours travailler. One must work, always work. And he said to him, go to the zoo and pick an animal and sit for a couple of days on a bench and watch this animal and then write about it. And out of that came one of Rilke's earliest, greatest poems, The Panther. Very short poem, but an extraordinary piece of identification with the object. And that's what the artist does. Keats said negative capability, to be able to be there while not being there. That's for me anyway, that's how art is made. It's not about ideas or politics or society or manners or anything. It's about conjuring the world into existence.
Concentration versus perhaps going for a walk. Why is
going for a walk can be concentration. I mean, people
ask me...
Thinking
about something by doing something else.
People ask me, when do I work? And I say, I work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I do. Everything that I do feeds into the work, of course.
Yeah.
Because that's what I am. I'm a working, I'm this machine that produces art.
I wanted to actually ask about the presence of so many thin people, especially girls, in A Death in Summer. And I'm not actually asking from a symbolic standpoint. I'm actually asking more from a process standpoint. In the case of A Death in Summer, there's one late moment where you describe Inspector Hackett as having a neat fat belly, like a pregnant girl. And part of me read that after all the imagery of thinness, and I just thought that was a very funny little capstone upon this. But it does have me wondering how aware you are. At one point do you see that there's this kind of like symmetry of thinness?
I'm not aware. I try not to be aware now. I try to let things happen. People constantly tell me things about my books that I don't know, that I wasn't aware of doing. But of course I did them.
Yes.
But no, I don't. I try not to plan. I try not to make links. I try to let a certain seeming incoherence. I try to work in a process of seeming incoherence, trusting that my subconscious or unconscious or whatever it is, or just the sentences themselves will make the connections, will make the sense.
You suggest
the art has to be organic, it has to grow of itself. You can't plan it. You plan a certain amount, but the greatest effects in a novel or a painting or the symphony or whatever will always be the bits where the artist lost control. I don't mean lost control of his material, but lost control of what he was doing. You know, the moment when you let something happen is an extraordinary moment.
You suggested that you don't do that now. Did you do that before?
I imagined that I was working according to strict rules. I mean, my book Kepler is divided into it has a system which mirrors Kepler's system of the universe, and five perfect solids fitting between the orbits of the planets, and there are 20 sides. This, I mean, it was immensely complicated. That was a way of working then. It was useful for me.
Yeah,
I couldn't work like that now. I wouldn't want to.
Was it the speed or the fact that things became too complex, or that it just felt truer and more original to not plan?
I just got older.
Yeah.
And that's my work methods changed. I changed. I began to realize that I didn't know everything about the world. You know, the old thing, the older you get, the more you realize, you know, how little you know.
Yeah.
And that is true. And that's a very good thing for an artist, I think, that humility.
Yes.
Before the material and before the world.
The degree to which you ensure that you don't use the same phrase and the same word in a manuscript, especially on the Banville side, what do you do? Is this a part of the process as well? Because I've noticed that, especially when a 10-cent word shows up in the Banville books, it has its one appearance very often from book to book to book. What do you do to, ensure that you don't repeat yourself?
I take great care.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the process of writing, you know. It's just it's what I do every day.
Yeah.
I've been doing it for 50 years now. To a certain extent, it comes naturally to be careful. But I still find silly things, especially when I'm doing public readings. Like, oh, God, look, use that word top of the page and the bottom of the page. You know, one can never be, as we began by saying, perfection is not of this world.
No. Yeah. What of distractions? I did read one interview where you were, you claimed that you were addicted to email, that every 30 seconds.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm absolutely addicted to email. It's become part of the rhythm of writing now, checking my email. It's pathetic. My wife got me a postcard to stick on my wall, which is a guy staring at a blank screen, and just on the screen is, you have no fucking emails.
Yes. I suppose Twitter or something like Google Plus would be out to lunch.
I can't. Possibly,
or Facebook, for that matter.
I can't possibly let myself do any of those. Emails are quite enough. Well, emails is the postman coming to your door every 30 seconds. You know,
yeah.
30 seconds is a bit much, but there is that sense when you're sitting there, you know, and you're staring vacantly. You think, oh, I haven't checked my emails for at least 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
The reviewer for the Los Angeles Times called this book a brainy beach read. How does that sit with you? Are you comfortable with the idea of you being a brainy beach read, or a beach read for that matter? Is that the mark of a craftsman?
Oh, yes, I would think so. That's a compliment, I suppose. It'll put people off, of course, but I wouldn't. You know, but I have far more regard for the reading public than I think many publishers have, or many book reviewers have. People know what they want. If they want some piece of easy reading, they'll buy that piece of easy reading. If they want something else, they'll buy that. It'll often be the same reader who will buy these at different times. So, yes, I mean, I would love to think that people would take this book to the beach.
Yeah.
I'd love to think that they'd take a Banville book to the beach.
Yeah.
You know? Wouldn't kill them.
Near the end of The Infinities, you have your wily narrator say, "Dogs are dim creatures. Do not speak to me of their good sense." And in 2009, you wrote about your Labrador for The Guardian. How is one to write about a family pet without plunging feet first into a slough of bilge and bathos? I'm wondering if dogs represent an aspect of our lives, an aspect of living, that to some degree is almost incompatible with words. Is bathos one of those human qualities that sometimes fells John Banville, but that maybe Benjamin Black might be able to pick up some sense of fluidity?
Well, I think dogs are extraordinary creatures. I mean, animals are it seems to me that one of the great tragedies of the modern age is that we've almost lost contact with the animal world. We treat them as if we are masters of the universe, as if they're just automata. Descartes, of course, has a lot to answer for in that regard. Animals, to me, are endlessly fascinating. My wife has a dog at the moment, and I think, which is the most magical creature I've come across in a long time. Big, goofy dog that came from a long line of dogs that worked on farms. He can't believe his luck to be in the lap of luxury in her house. Clever, silly, funny, playful. Don't get me started on dogs. They're wonderful creatures. But in the wider aspect, people often talk of me as being a postmodernist writer, which is nonsense. Although I notice that's a term that's falling out of use now, thank God, because it doesn't really mean anything. But if I were to describe myself post anything, I would be post-humanist, in that I do not see human beings as the center of the universe. My characters are characters in a landscape. And the world that I create, that Bamber creates, and even the Black creates, is just as important as the people inhabiting it. Mm-hmm. This is a hard thing to accept, but it's true for me. The world for me is a living object, and we happen to be viruses on it, the most successful virus the world has ever known.
Yeah.
And of course, miraculously gifted virus. Look at the things we've done. You know, for every Hitler, there's a Beethoven. We have done miraculous things. But we're still not as far away from the animals as we think we are. You know, there's this notion, which is latent in our minds, that at some point in the evolutionary scale, we took a sort of a skip. We took a step upwards that separated us from the animals, that we are now sort of demigods. And this is simply not the case. We are fantastically complicated, fantastically intelligent, fantastically inventive animals, but we're still animals. And we should keep that in mind.
Can words capture all the complexities of this Cartesian dilemma, this animal-human dilemma?
Words can only suggest, they can't capture. I mean, you know, in a way, all writing is a kind of conjuring trick. You're setting up a world that looks like, as I said earlier, looks like, feels like, tastes like the real world, but it's not. So it's all to do with suggestion. And of course, the power of suggestion depends on the artistic gifts of the writer.
What about the potential for manipulating a reader? Is this something that you try to avoid? You would rather suggest than manipulate?
I have no sense of a reader whatever when I'm writing. I write entirely for myself. Then when it's finished, it becomes the reader's. But while I'm doing it, it's for me. And I believe the same is true of all writers, whatever they say. You cannot write with an audience in mind. Unless, you know, you're writing a textbook or a completely formulaic crime novel or something. But if you've got any self-respect and you're a real writer, you'll write for yourself. And then the miracle is that other people find in your work things that seem absolutely personal to them. This is a very strange process. I mean, when I published The Sea, I did various travels, and people would say to me, I remember a woman in Hong Kong saying to me, "This is my childhood." I said, "But you're Chinese, you're born in Hong Kong." She said, "Dad, that was my childhood." Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Best compliment one could have.
Okay. Well, on that note, John, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was a pleasure for me too.